I call Senate Resources Committee meeting to order. Today is Wednesday, April 8th, 2026, and the time is 3:30 p.m. Members present today, Senator Rauscher, Senator Myers, Senator Dunbar, Senator Klayman, and myself, Senator Giesel. I expect Senator Kawasaki and Senator Wilikowski to be along shortly. We have a quorum to conduct business. Thank you to Heather and Chloe, who are keeping the minutes and running the audio for us. We have three items on the agenda today. We're going to hear a confirmation hearing, first of all, from Julie Vogler. She is being appointed as a commissioner to the RCA. That's a Regulatory Commission of Alaska. Then we will hear HJR 18, urging support for AKLNG. And lastly, we'll hear Senate Bill 226, first hearing on homemade food, reduced oxygen packing. So first up, confirmation of Julie Vogler, commissioner for the RCA. Members have her resume in the packet. I would invite you, Ms. Vogler, forward. While you're coming forward, I'm going to review for committee members the commission's role and qualifications. If I can turn the pages, I'll get there. You have in your packet a document that outlines the people that are filling the positions right now. The piece that comes from the Boards and Commissions website is incorrect. In House Bill 307 in 2024, we made changes to the qualifications and the pay scale for the commissioners. So House Bill 307 reads, commission will consist of five commissioners. And the qualifications for appointment, number one, be a member in good standing of the Alaska Bar Association with at least 5 years of actual experience in the practice of law. Be a professional engineer registered under AS 0848 or have a degree from an accredited college or university with a major in finance, economics, accounting, business administration, or public administration, and at least 5 years of actual experience in the field associated with the degree. So that is the current language from the statute book, by the way, as well as from the bill. The statute books are updated. The website is not. The pay range was increased. The website says 27, range 27. It was increased to range 29 for this position. So just an update on that. So Ms. Vogler is being appointed, and welcome to the committee. I'll let you introduce yourself and let us know why you'd like to serve on the commission.
Thank you. Good afternoon. For the record, Julie Vogler, RCA Commissioner. Thank you for the opportunity for allowing me to be here today. I was appointed by Governor Dunleavy on March 11th, 2026, for a six-year term to replace Robert M. Pickett. I meet the statutory qualifications to be appointed as a commissioner. I earned two bachelor's degrees, finance and accounting, from the University of Alaska Anchorage and have over 21 years of regulatory experience. I began my career at the RCA in 2004 as a utility financial analyst one, the entry-level position in the finance series. I progressed through the series and in 2015 became the financial analyst four, the advanced level in the series that also includes supervisory responsibilities. In this role, I also temporarily served as the advisory section manager, where I had oversight over both the finance and tariff sections. In 2022, my progression continued and I became a utility master analyst. I played a role in the Power Cost Equalization Program, or PCE, I've played a role in the Power Cost Equalization, or PCE, since I joined the commission in 2004. For the first few years, I managed the PCE program for non-economically regulated utilities, and several years later, when staff resources were limited, I again managed the PCE program while maintaining my additional workload. In my supervisory role, I provided guidance to the analyst too, that managed the PCE program, and most recently, as a master analyst, I provided extensive training to the utility financial analyst one that was newly hired. I was fortunate early on in my career to have the opportunity to be assigned complex rate filings as advanced level analysts left the commission. I took that as an opportunity and started to teach myself all things rate making. I was assigned as staff on dockets and filings for all utility types, which included surcharge filings, rate filings, gas supply agreements, regulatory assets, and regulations dockets. As I advanced through the finance series, assigned filings became more complex, some being controversial and precedential in nature. As a master analyst, I was an advisor to the commissions, providing the guidance in the decision-making process and performing qualitative and quantitative analysis of both complex and non-complex matters for regulated utilities and pipeline carriers and non-economic regulated utilities. In both my finance and master analyst roles, I mentored, trained, and provided guidance to staff members in other sections of the agency, developed and implemented procedures to provide consistency amongst the advisory section, independently developed agency-wide procedures and workflows, collaborated with management to develop section-specific procedures and workflows, and most recently developed the procedure for the implementation of the regulatory cost charge at the RCA. For the last 2 years, I've been the lead legislative liaison for the commission, which includes communicating and meeting with legislators and staff, presenting before committees, attending committee hearings to respond to questions, and reviewing and drafting of fiscal notes. As a commissioner, I continue to be involved in all legislative matters. As an analyst, I was responsible for thoroughly reviewing the record in a proceeding, whether that be a PCE filing, a tariff filing, or a docketed matter, ensuring compliance with applicable statutes and regulations, and providing the commissioners with an analysis and a recommended path forward. I was objective in my review and analysis, which resulted in recommendations that were also objective. This is a skill set that I have now and bring with me to my role as a commissioner. I look forward to continuing to serve as a commissioner at the RCA. I'm excited for the opportunity and I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Vogler. Questions from committee members? Senator Klayman.
Thank you, Ms. Vogler. I think you may be a historic person for an appointment to the RCA Commission in that you have roughly, actually a little more than 20 years of on-the-job training in kind of almost every facet of how the RCA works. How do you think that experience will help you in your work as a commissioner?
For the record, Julie Vogler, through the chair, to Senator Klayman, that experience that I've gained working on all the different utility types and different types of filings as an analyst digging into those filings, I now have that knowledge to gain for the understanding that I will need as a commissioner.
Thank you.
Any other questions from committee members? All right, seeing none, I will now open public testimony on this appointee. Is there anyone in the room that wishes to testify on the appointment of Ms. Julie Vogler to the RCA? Seeing no one, I see no one online either. So I'm closing public testimony. Very good. No other questions from committee members? All right. In accordance with Article 3, Sections 26 and 27 of the Alaska Constitution and AS 3905080, the Resources Committee held a hearing on the following appointee. A signature on this report does not reflect an intent by any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of this individual during any further sessions. Regulatory Commission of Alaska, Julie Vogler, appointed 3/11/26, term expires 3/1/2032. So I will pass this around and have members sign it. Thank you very much, Ms. Vogler, for being present with us today.
Thank you.
Next, we're going to move on. While that paper is being passed around and I'll let people sign on it, we're going to move forward with HJR 18. This is urging support for AKLNG. This was last up this is the second hearing on this resolution. The first time we heard it, we adopted a Senate Resources Committee substitute. So here to refresh us on the resolution is Zach Young. Welcome, Mr. Young. So again, if you would just give us a brief overview of the purpose of the resolution.
Welcome. Good afternoon, and thank you, Chair Giesel and members of the Senate Resources Committee. I am Zach Young, staff to Representative Mia Costello. HJR 18 is about seizing the long-awaited opportunity for Alaska and taking advantage of its tremendous natural gas resources. Estimates show that nearly 30 trillion cubic feet of natural gas is recoverable from multiple fields on the North Slope, with many more trillions of cubic feet still yet to be discovered. For decades, we've known that North Slope gas is a major national energy asset, and this resolution underscores a gas line from the North Slope to South Central Alaska and an LNG export project can finally turn that resource into thousands of high-paying jobs, long-term state and local revenue, and affordable energy for our communities. HJR 18 specifically recognizes the benefits to Interior and Yukon River communities through a spur line to Fairbanks and related infrastructure that can help bring down the crushing cost of heat and power to Interior communities. It also acknowledges the hard work that has already been completed by the state of Alaska, years of environmental review, permitting, and attracting international interest. And now that we now hold the only federally authorized proposed LNG export project on the U.S. Pacific Coast, offering our allies a direct, secure energy corridor. HGR 18 simply asks our federal partners, the Secretaries of Interior and Energy, FERC, and our congressional delegation to move forward with urgency, to expedite approvals, coordinate agency review, and secure federal funding so that this project can move from concept to construction.
Thank you very much, Mr. Young. Any questions for Mr. Young? All right, seeing none. There you go, Senator Rauscher.
So I don't have a question, but and thank you, Madam Chair. But I don't wish to object it moving out of committee, but I do want to say something about it.
Well, certainly, Senator Rauscher, we're going to have public testimony.
Okay.
And if you'd like to make a comment now,
I can wait till
fine.
Later. I just, as long as I know the process.
Here. Yep.
If that's really a process, I'll wait.
All right. Great. Thank you, Mr. Young. I am going to open public testimony right now. Is there anyone in the room that wishes to testify on the resolution? Please come forward. Could I ask if you signed in out at the?
I did.
Okay, great. She'll provide your name to the secretary for the committee. But if you would introduce yourself now, any affiliation that you have, and time is 2 minutes to testify.
I better hurry. Chair Giesel and members of the committee, my name is Doug Woodby. I'm with 350 Juneau, and I thank you for this opportunity to comment. I don't support the resolution, and I'm going to focus on the economic and social factors. Concerns with that. First concern, as some in the legislature recognize, Glenfarne, along with AGDC, has a credibility gap. And this is due in part to not disclosing new cost estimates and continually issuing glowing press releases, despite not having any firm commitments from buyers. This project may drastically increase the cost of gas to consumers. We need firm cost estimates. Concern three, 2 years ago this month, in a letter to the legislature, AGDC vowed to, quote, shut itself down if it couldn't secure funding for the entire project or just the initial phase, end quote. And that was by the end of 2024. So the question is, why are they still being funded by the state? And this committee last year noted that the total cost of the state as of that time was nearly $1 billion. Concern four, the project developers and the governor have indicated that the project is not economically viable without property tax reductions, and that's going to come at the cost of funds for schools, public safety, and so many other needs for communities. Concern five, while the resolution speaks to the needs of Fairbanks, the project does not include a pipeline to Fairbanks that I could see. Concern six, and then there's Glenfarne's suggestion that the state invest big time in the project, but our only cash cow is the permanent fund. I testified to the Permanent Fund Corporation on February 23rd, and I asked Is the permanent fund considering investing in the Alaska LNG project? And also, can they commit billions of dollars without legislative approval? Chair Jason Bruni answered that he in fact had a phone call with Glenn Farren earlier that very morning, but he didn't specify the contents of that conversation. And the question remains whether legislative approval is needed or prudent for large investments. Concern seven, AGDC has admitted that phase one isn't viable without phase two, yet the success of phase two, selling LNG on the world market, is very problematic.
If you would wrap up.
I will. Thank you. I won't describe those problems, but my eighth and final concern is that the promotion of the project is a great distraction from meeting the real needs of Alaskans for energy. The cost efficient energy cost is a major issue, and there's no guarantee that the gas for consumers in Alaska is going to be cost effective. I thank you for your time. I'd be happy to take questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Woodby. Any questions for Mr. Woodby? All right, seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the room who wishes to testify? All right, I'm going to go online. I have Ben Bodiger, Energy Policy Analyst, Cook Inlet Keeper. Mr. Bodiger, I'm sure I'm mispronouncing your name, but welcome.
Thank you. I'm Ben Becker, Energy Policy Specialist for Cook and the Keeper, and I'm opposing the resolution. As the previous commenter mentioned, despite a turn to press release, and as your committee has seen, benefit to Alaskan heat and electricity bills is questionable. As it has for many years, the project continues to dance around the central question of how much pipe and North Slope gas would cost Alaskan utilities and the community they serve. You see the 2024 cost estimate that Wood Mackenzie produced in response to a legislative mandate for this project show economic value. Their cost estimate misleadingly assumed, as a default, the contentious 90% tax break that we've heard opposition to from the borough mayors. In GDC's recent cost estimates, assume as a baseline the capital cost estimates of $46 billion, which they note to be outdated. Glenn Farren has commissioned a FEED study that has the most recent and most rigorous capital cost estimate, and they should reveal that and use that to calculate the cost of gas. They continue to be vague about this question in material they recently shared with House Energy. They modeled the phase one gas costs between $10 to $15 dollars per thousand cubic foot. Other consultants have estimated the imported LNG to also be in that cost range. So transparency and precision really matters here. And until the project developers are transparent with the legislature about this essential question of gas cost, they haven't earned the unqualified legislative support for this resolution we did. The Senate Resources Committee has been appropriately skeptical towards Alaska LNG, and your skepticism serves Alaskans better than this resolution. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Committee members, any questions for Mr. Bodiger? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. I don't see anyone else online wishing to testify on House Joint Resolution number 18, so I'm closing public testimony. With that, is there further questions or comments from committee members? Senator Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, yeah, like I said, I don't really want to object to it moving out of committee if that's where it's headed, but So I just think version H removes some language that's necessary, which shows conviction in the potential of the project. And there's a lot of could language in there now where I think maybe wood was a better choice, like could create jobs. I think it's going to create jobs. So I think wood would be a much better word there, and it could provide provide long-term infrastructure. I think it definitely would provide long-term infrastructure, but and I think it just kind of looks kind of doubtful on our position instead of our position being supportive. But I'm reading that into it now, and I'm just wondering if that's if anybody else is seeing what I'm seeing, and that's what I'm just bringing that up. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator Rocher. Further comments or questions from committee members? All right, seeing none, Senator Wilikowski, I would look for a motion.
Madam Chair, I move House Joint Resolution version 34-LS0837/H as in HUNA from...
I'm sorry.
My time's up. From committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note, legislative legal has the authority to make any technical and conforming changes.
Thank you. Are there any objections? Seeing none, HJR 18 version 8 H moves from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note. I will let my staff circulate the document, the committee document, but we will move forward with, while she's doing that, with Senate Bill 226. This is entitled Homemade Food Reduced Oxygen Packaging. And I will invite forward my staff, Samantha Freeborn, to present the bill. Welcome, Ms. Freeborn.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Samantha Freeborn, staff to Senator Giesel. Senate Bill 226, an act relating to the sale of homemade foods, introduces a focus change that separates high botulism risk foods prepared in reduced oxygen packaging from products that qualify under Alaska's homemade food exemption. This bill does not eliminate or broadly restrict the homemade food industry. The vast majority of products remain unaffected and available for sale. Products such as high acid foods in vacuum sealed and unsealed containers, examples are jams, jellies, pickles, as well as preserves, baked goods, and fresh items, sandwiches and salads. Items of the highest concern are low acid foods, including meats, vegetables, and products containing them. These products present a serious botulism risk when vacuum sealed or canned, creating anaerobic or low oxygen environments. This change does not limit these foods from personal consumption or their ability to be sold utilizing other preparation methods, such as fresh or frozen. For example, you could sell beef stew, fresh or frozen, but just not in low oxygen packaging, such as a can or a vacuum sealed envelope. Currently, these foods are sold as non-potentially hazardous with no oversight, including through third-party agents like cafes and grocery stores. This highlights the potential public risk should these items be improperly prepared. Botulism is one of the most lethal poisons known to humans and animals. It causes difficulty breathing, muscle paralysis, and can be fatal. Symptoms typically appear 18 to 36 hours after exposure, but can be delayed up to 10 days. Alaska has one of the highest rates in the United States, sometimes accounting for as many as half of all reported cases nationwide each year. Almost all cases reported have been associated with consumption of traditionally prepared Alaska native foods. However, Madam Chair, provided in today's documents, the committee will have a copy of the August 2019 Epidemiology Bulletin titled Botulism from Home Canned Salmon for your review, which details the occurrence of a case in Alaska from home canned fish. This case highlights potential concerns regarding public health and exposure if unregulated high-risk products are sold to the public. The burden of ensuring that homemade foods are safe lands entirely on the producer of the product. Botulism is a life-threatening illness and constitutes a public health emergency. Reducing the risk of botulism protects consumers and helps safeguard small local businesses from the severe economic and legal consequences that could result from even a single case. It also reduces the burden to the state, which must respond to botulism cases with significant public health resources. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Ms. Freeborn. Any questions for Ms. Freeborn? Yes, Senator
Myers.
Myers, thank you. Sorry, Senator Myers.
Day's almost over. It's okay. So in the sponsor statement, we mention looks like between 2017 and 2024, 24 cases of botulism in Alaska. Do we know how many of those cases occurred because of sold homemade food, not just homemade food as in the case you just mentioned with the homemade canned salmon, but food that was sold?
I do not have the answer to that question at this time, but I would be happy to follow up with you at another time, Senator Myers, through the chair.
So, Senator Myers, not all of it has been through sold food. Mm-hmm. A few years ago, we passed a law that allows homemade foods to be sold, mm-hmm. right? But there was a glitch in the bill in that it didn't include these type of high-risk foods, which in an anaerobic environment that's without oxygen, botulism can form. The case study that is in the bill actually really outlines the deadliness and the speed with which botulism can take control of someone's health. I mean, this man, within a few hours, the next morning, began to have the facial weakness, the blurred vision, was immediately rushed to the emergency room, but he ended up intubated and on a respirator, mechanical ventilation, for 39 hours as the botulina pathogen was passing through his body and the antitoxin was taking effect. So this actually kills people. There is an interesting additional document that is included, botulism in Alaska, is also in the packet. And it has on page 15... Well, that's the symptoms. There was a documentation. Here we go, the outbreaks reported in food sources on page 14. It outlines the number of outbreaks of botulism. And this is in Alaska. So you can see it's not unusual. Fish being one of the most common, fish and seal. And as Ms. Freeborn said, a lot of times it's traditional foods that are actually putrefying versus fermenting, but they're not sterilely sealed, and so that's when the botulina toxin can develop. It also goes into infant botulism, which is another interesting one. Some people may not know that infants are not supposed to get honey before 1 year of age because of botulism is common in honey itself. So the purpose of this, though, is to just close that loophole in the foods that can be sold. Not so much what you can do in your own home or give to your family or whatever. But it also, this particular bulletin really calls out the best way to safely prepare it with the brining of it, making sure that you use a pressure cooker to actually seal the containers and so forth. Other questions, Senator Myers?
Not just yet. I'll wait until later in the presentation.
I do have two folks online. They are here only for questions. Louisa Castrodale is Infectious Disease Program Manager, Division of Public Health, Department of Health. And Sonde Perry, Director, Division of Environmental Health, Department of Environmental Health, is also online. We had an invited testimony person who could not be here today, but these folks are online for questions. Did you have specific questions you'd like to ask, Senator Myers?
I do have one other one.
Okay.
I'm curious about. So in the bill you referenced, that we passed a couple of years ago, one of the pieces in it said, this is in subsection H, subject to the requirements of federal law, a person may prepare and sell meat products, etc. And I'm just curious, how the provisions in the bill before us compare to the provisions in federal laws as far as selling homemade food goes.
All right. Let's see. Well, why don't we, Ms. Perry, can you hear us? Did you hear the question from Senator Myers?
Yes, I did, Senator Diesel. This is Shawnee Perry, Department of Environmental Conservation, Environmental Health Division Director. And regarding the prior bill that was passed, the provision of the ability to provide homemade foods with meats would be through, as long as the homeowner would purchase meats through, you know, a grocery store where USDA has inspected the meat. Does that help answer the question, Senator?
Senator Myers.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm just curious. So we're looking at this in the bill that's in front of us now. We're talking about a specific type of preparation and then packaging. And I'm curious if federal law already has an influence on that a particular direction it goes, and if that this bill makes us more restrictive, less restrictive, kind of how the two compare.
Ms.
Sure, Chair, Senator. I believe that I'm thinking of how I can answer. I believe one example maybe I can give you regarding food safety and a hazard analysis. It's a hazard analysis critical control point plan that would be required for licensed facilities, for example, to do processed foods with reduced oxygen packaging. So something like vacuum sealed meat jerky, vacuum sealed prepped meals. So that is a process that our food safety and sanitation works with licensed facilities to produce and provide safely. So this provision would be limiting just the homemade food home producers to restrict them from selling this type of product. So, yes, there are provisions in place otherwise.
Follow-up, Senator Myers?
Yeah, just to clarify, it sounds like you're saying that if the 226 in front of us that passed, it would make us more restrictive than federal law in that case. Is that accurate?
Through the chair, Senator, that's correct. The existing federal law is tailored to permitted facilities. So with the prior homemade food bill that was passed, that's the state of Alaska's provision for homemade food producers, which the federal regulations I'd have to look into to give you the differences between the two. But in this case, it's pretty limited to the homemade food producers that are exempt from the homemade food bill.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. And I don't know whoever can answer this, if the sponsor wants to answer or if somebody online could. Two things on the potentially hazardous homemade food. What exactly would constitute a potentially hazardous homemade food? And is it based on like the acidity or is it based on the – what's it based on?
I think I will ask Louisa Casterdale – with the Infectious Disease Program Manager to respond to that question. Senator Kawasaki, Ms. Casterdale?
Hi, thanks, Lady Chair. This is Louisa Casterdale with the State Sex of Epidemiology Department of Health. I feel like potentially hazardous food is actually given a definition in other food code. Is that, I might defer to DEC for that.
Okay, you feel like that the DEC has that as a definition?
Yes, potentially hazardous food, through the chair, is defined as a food or drink that requires time or temperature for control. I don't know. This is Luke Castriel, Section of Epidemiology, through the chair. I feel like that term, potentially hazardous food, is defined in other pieces of DEC food code.
All right. We have a hard time hearing you, so I don't know if you're on a speakerphone, but it can be hard to hear. Ms. Perry, do you have that definition in code?
Yes, Senator. I don't have it in front of me, but Ms. Castordale is correct that potentially hazardous foods are foods that require time or temperature control. So soups, sandwiches, salads, or cooked dishes.
Could you repeat those three examples again? I didn't quite catch what they were.
Sure, yes, Senator. So potentially hazardous foods are foods that require time or temperature control. And an example could be soups, sandwiches, salads, or things like cooked dishes.
All right. Thank you. Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. So let me clarify. So, I mean, I'm guessing so potentially hazardous homemade food could include anything that has an expiration date, is perishable, requires microwaving before eating, or you wouldn't want to eat it unless it's microwaved, those kinds of things.
Through the chair, Senator, yes, that's correct.
Okay. Senator Kawasaki. This is for those foods that are in reduced oxygen packaging. That's the key part.
Okay.
So that's did you have
the second part of my question?
Yes.
Then would be so it sounds like a lot of different foods are in that section because I'm just thinking of people that now currently sell under this food exemption now. And then so the reduced oxygen packaging, would that include something like plastic wrap, saran wrap over a bowl of something, soup?
Ms. Perry, would you respond to his question?
Senator Giesel, this is Shawnee Perry with that question for DC.
I thought you could possibly answer the question.
Sure. Yes, Senator. Shawnee Perry for the record. The reduced oxygen packaging example would be vacuum sealed products. Vacuum sealed meat jerky or prepared meals or low acid canned vegetables.
Follow up, Senator Kawasaki?
Yeah, so like if a steak were sous vide, like it's in a pressurized container, right? And it's all the oxygen's taken out of it. They do it now commonly for meals that you cook at home. Like you could buy them at actually, a lot of restaurants actually use them too. So they're automatically, they're sort of pre-cooked. You take them out of the package, you throw them in the container, and then you just heat it up in the microwave. Would that be included?
Ms. Perry?
Senator Shawnee Perry for the record. That would, I think we're trying to define between potentially hazardous foods and reduced oxygen packaging. So my understanding with potentially hazardous foods, if a food is prepared in a pressure cooker, for example, and then taken out and kept at temperature, that would be a potentially hazardous food and not considered reduced oxygen packaging.
Senator Kawasaki, I'll also draw your attention on page 2, line 3, where the word homemade is articulated. It's a homemade food. So someone cans their salmon at home and they seal it at home. The example in the public health bulletin is a man that did that, didn't achieve an adequate seal, had not brined the fish, had not pressure cooked the container to adequately seal it, and consumed it. Okay, this is for homemade foods that would be put up for sale versus a restaurant.
So the reason why I'm asking the questions specifically on what the hazardous food is and then second what the reduced packaging is that there are some people who've taken advantage of the home this exemption and then they do meals at home and then they sell them online, for instance. And if you go to your Facebook or whatever, you can always find these things. And I'm just curious if they're impacted or to what extent they might be impacted. They're prepared foods. I don't know whether they do use reduced oxygen packaging or not. So.
Ms. Perry, do you have a comment on his question?
Yes, Madam Chair. Shawnee Perry for the record. I think it would help the committee, I would be happy to get back with the program and provide a response in writing, and maybe that could better articulate for senators.
Thank you. Ms. Freeborn, the Public Health Department regulator that oversees this homemade food provision is not available today for invited testimony, but you have heard her testimony. Do you have any recall that might help Senator Kawasaki today?
Madam Chair, or through the Chair, Senator Kawasaki, my understanding is that it would restrict the packaging utilized, specifically not the food sold, but the packaging used as far as vacuum sealed containers or jars. Sarah Lewis from the UAF Cooperative Extension has provided me with a list of low oxygen packaging. If that is helpful, I'd be happy to provide that. The list is as follows: vacuum sealed plastic bags, jars that have been processed with heat to pasteurize the food and jar and create a vacuum sealed lid when cooled, jars and containers that have been vacuum sealed themselves, jars that have not been processed with heat but are allowed to vacuum seal by using the residual heat of the contents. So that would be like a water bath canning.
Okay. Thanks.
All right. Senator Rauscher.
So thank you. So speaking in favor of the bill, I appreciate the bill, by the way. I do. I appreciate your bill, by the way. But I will have a question. In the statement, the sponsor statement, I'm trying to understand where we're at as far as the state of Alaska is. It says in the fourth paragraph, during the 8 years between 2017 and 2024, 24 cases of foodborne botulism were reported in Alaska, which has one of the highest rates in the United States, often accounting for as many as 50% of the cases reported in the United States in a single year. Were the foods prepared in Alaska, or were they just consumed in Alaska?
Ms. Freeborn?
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Rauscher, my understanding is the cases are from Alaska Native traditional foods, with the exception of the case from August of 2019 of the home canned salmon in Alaska. Prepared in Alaska.
Senator Rush, your follow-up?
Thank you. Through all 24 cases?
Ms. Freeborn?
My apologies, through the chair. If I could, I would like to confirm that number with you at a later date.
That's
fair. Senator Rauscher.
That's fair. You bet.
All right. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. It sounded like when you were describing the process, you said water baths. You make jelly with water baths typically. It sounds like that would be excluded from, or that sounds like that would be included in this definition, or is that not the case?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski. I do have a list provided to me by the UAF Cooperative Extension. Berries, jams, jellies, and other sweet spreads would be allowable under the exemption because they are listed under high acid foods.
Okay. So just to
clarify. Follow up, Senator Wilikowski.
So just following through on the definition. So they're not considered a potentially hazardous homemade food.
Ms. Freeborn?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski. Potentially hazardous foods as listed in the UAF Cooperative Extension handout, low acid salsa, fruits, or spreads. The handout here lists fruits, jams, and jellies under high acid foods. So I would, based off of this handout, I would not consider them a low acid or potentially hazardous food.
And for clarification, no. Jams, jellies, etc. are not included as high hazardous foods.
Great. Thank you.
Unless it's made out of meat.
Pardon me?
Unless it's made out of meat. You should make a meat jelly. Whatever you float your boat.
Okay. Further questions? All right. Seeing none, there is the intention to have Sarah Lewis present. She is the individual from the Department of Public Health who educates the public on how to do safe home canned foods, and is the person that brought this issue to my attention. We will have her at a future hearing. If there are any other questions, I don't see anyone online who wishes to testify. I'll open public testimony. I don't see anyone online. Is there anyone in the room that wishes to testify on Senate Bill 226? All right, seeing none, I will close public testimony. And we're going to set this bill aside. I am going to set an amendment deadline for it, but I'm not going to do that today. I'd like to wait until Sarah Luce is here so that she can fill in the blanks here. And then you can decide if you want to offer any amendments to it. So we'll set it, just simply set it aside for now. So that concludes our agenda for today. So the next meeting will be on Friday, April 10th at 3:30. We have four bills before us at that time. Senate Joint Resolution 20, Clean Up Marine Debris. Senate Bill 208, Agricultural Land Leases. We will hear Senate Bill 226, Homemade Food, again. And lastly, Senate Bill 192, first hearing on evacuation designation levels. So at this time, the meeting will adjourn. Let the record reflect it is 4:16 p.m.